My name is Bob Reese. I am the organizer and moderator of this distinguished panel on this important subject. Anybody know what all of that's about?
You got power, Bob.
Somewhere. This session grew out of conversations I had over the past several years with several people, including two of the panelists, Kendall Wilcox and Randall Paul. A longer conversation I've had over a longer period of time with Warner, who's on the panel today. In these conversations, I've been impressed by these individuals' understanding both of these particular virtues and their importance in our spiritual, religious, social, and political lives. I was pleased when Emily Clyde Curtis agreed to join the panel, both because I suspect that women have special insights into these ways of responding to others, and because of her practical experience as a chaplain, which has given her ample opportunity to develop and express empathy, sympathy, and compassion. Warner is probably the most well-known and most innovative Latter-day Saint, as well as teacher, who has influenced several generations of young entrepreneurs and has inspired a number of entrepreneurial projects all over the world. I think Warner would probably agree that one of the really promising things, both in Mormon culture and in the culture at large, are the number of people who, of their own free will and choice, are doing things that address real needs and that use these virtues. When I was back at the White House reception on gay and lesbian issues last month, one of the people who was working with us, we went to dinner afterwards, and she has been a correspondent on the White House for 20 years. And she said two things. One, she said, apropos of nothing as we were sitting around dinner, she said, few things in my experience have been more impressive to me than what your church did with Katrina, in response to Katrina. She said it was absolutely wonderful to see a group of Latter-day Saints without an agenda, without anyone kind of waiting around for something to happen, to take charge and do things that really made an enormous difference in that community. She said, I was very impressed. The other thing she said is we were talking about different entrepreneurial humanitarian efforts. She said, I told you that one of the things that my wife and I did was to give our children, our grandchildren, gift certificates for Heifer International, so they could say they've given goats or sheep or whatever else as we've given them, but it's in their name. And she said, you know, I found that Heifer International does a lot of good, but they're kind of expensive. So she said, a couple of years ago, I started a foundation called Goats for the Old Goat. She said, I'm the old goat. And she said, we're working in Africa, and we get people to buy a goat, and that goat provides milk and cheese and other things. And she just talked about how one person's experience, spontaneous as it were, doing something of this nature. Anyway, what I'd like to do today as moderator participant in the panel is to stop this noise, is to say a few words of introduction that attempts to distinguish among these virtues, and then ask a few questions that I hope the panel will address or consider addressing. I asked a bunch of questions yesterday on a panel, and all the panelists totally ignored them, so that may also be the case here today. I'll ask Kendall, Emily, Randy, and Werner to, in that order, to share their personal perspectives and experiences on this subject. Following their remarks, we'll open the discussion to the audience, and at the end, I'll make some closing remarks that I hope will provide an adequate summary of our time together. But at the outset, it would be helpful to distinguish among the three ways of responding the compromise that comprise the subject of our panel today: empathy, sympathy, and compassion. Empathy is, quote, an intellectual and emotional awareness and understanding of another's thoughts, feelings, and behavior, even those that are distressing and disturbing. Sympathy moves from understanding to identifying and feeling what another person feels. Thus, quote, empathy emphasizes understanding, where sympathy emphasizes sharing of another person's feelings and experiences. empathy is different from sympathy, and that one can be empathetic. To be empathetic, one understands how the person feels rather than actually experiencing those feelings. Thus, sympathy involves feelings of pity and sorrow for someone else's misfortune. But compassion is related to both empathy and sympathy, nevertheless moves beyond understanding and identifying with another person's feelings to actually having, quote, a strong desire to alleviate the distress or suffering of the other person. Stephen Crippen articulates these differences. Empathy involves noticing and understanding someone else's experience, situation, and perspective. Empathy does not mean you agree or share the feeling or see it the other person's way. It only means you get it. You get how they see their problem. Sympathy is not just understanding another person's perspective, it's also feeling to some significant degree the same way the other person feels. And compassion is empathy plus action or sympathy plus help. For example, if I empathize or sympathize with someone, I haven't really done anything yet, at least anything active or concrete. I might be offering them a helpful presence, just being there, just listening, but I haven't really tried to assist them in their recovery or anything. Compassion adds this part to the transaction. Compassion means that not only do I empathize, not only do I sympathize, but I want to do or say something that will help them with the problem. An example would be, my brother-in-law was driving under the influence of alcohol and hit and killed a pedestrian. When I realized that he came from an abusive home, I felt empathy for him, but I don't sympathize with the choices he made to act so irresponsibly. However, I do feel compassion for him because he's going to prison for manslaughter, which is causing him and his family great pain. I plan to visit him in prison to do what I can to help his family. Max Lucado offers another example, one that may be more relevant to our discussion today. Compassion is one aspect of love. Compassion may grow from feelings, but true compassion represents a practical attention to someone's needs. It doesn't require us to feel, it requires us to act. Sympathy says, I feel bad that you're hungry. Empathy says, I know something about how you feel. I was hungry once myself. But compassion says, friend, let's go get something to eat. Sympathy and empathy don't require us to do anything, but compassion will cause us to touch, lift, feed, and help those in need, as Jesus did for the leper. So one of the questions I would like my fellow panelists to discuss is whether and to what extent these virtues can be taught and cultivated. That is, are people born empathetic? Can we teach them how to be more empathetic? What kinds of things make them less so? A fascinating article in the 15th July 2012 edition of the New York Times reported on various experiments that demonstrated that when experiencing another person's plight or suffering, people tend to respond more sympathetically to a non-sympathetic participant. The researchers contend that the results of their study gives evidence of a scientific basis for compassion. One experiment, which had participants tap their hands on a sensor to tones played over earphones, so they're going like this, was designed so that two participants tapped in synchrony at times and in a random, mismatching manner at other times. They were then given an opportunity to respond to a situation with or without compassion. According to the report, quote, the results were striking. The simple act of tapping one's hands in synchrony with another person caused our participants to report feeling more similar to their partners and to have a greater compassion for their plight. That's when they changed partners and this other person was shown in an unsympathetic way, or shown in a way that evoked sympathy. It increased the number of people who helped their partner by 31% and increased the average time spent helping them from 1 minute to more than seven. The conclusion, simply learning to mentally recategorize one another in terms of commonalities would generate greater empathy among all of us and foster social harmony in a fairly effortless way. But there are a lot of very interesting studies going on in terms of sympathy, empathy, and compassion, and I think those have implications for any further understanding we have of these virtues. One question we might consider is what implications does such research have for Latter-day Saint families and congregations? So we'll now hear from the panelists, and we'll have you get a chance to weigh in on this subject, either make statements or ask questions, and then I will make some concluding remarks. Who's first? Did I say Kendall? And then
yes.
Emily?
I think so.
And then Brandon. There we go. of the order.
All right.
I think mostly I'm going to address Bob's question on can we and how do we potentially cultivate these attributes, specifically empathy. And even more specifically, I come at this from a very practical standpoint. I'm not as much of a theoretician as a practitioner. I come from a background in communications and specifically documentary filmmaking. And just a quick history on me, for those that don't know, I've worked for BYU and the church audiovisual, and in the CES program for about 20 years, and last year came out as gay, and because I had reached a point in my life where I was reaching such despondency, not just because of the challenge of reconciling those two aspects of my life, but most specifically, it was because I was witnessing as a participant and maybe a purveyor of some aspects of church culture and communication styles within our church culture. I was witnessing such a horrific breakdown in our abilities to communicate and dialogue and have conversations about this very obviously divisive issue in our culture. And that became my chief concern. Because I reached such a point of despondency that I was actually genuinely suicidal, and because I felt like if we cannot just communicate, don't have to agree, communicate about this on a level that respects our shared humanity, I'm done. I this is not a world I want to live in. I don't know how. I just couldn't find it within me, which led me to. I get a sense of personal revelation in praying and genuinely deciding whether to continue my life or not. What are my options? The impression came over and over that to emphasize, at least within my work and my sphere of influence, on trying to find ways, if we can, to cultivate empathy, to start at empathy. And specifically trying to understand how to cultivate applied empathy in this very specific context of the intersection or the nexus between homosexuality and Mormonism, and even specifically within that, just within the dialogues and the conversations that we have throughout our culture. And by conversations, I mean all the way from sort of the internal dialogue that one has, whether gay or straight and Mormon, or the interpersonal conversations that we have within families, within our church congregations, and then also the larger community conversations that are going on all around us. So I began to explore the role that applied and increased empathy can have in facilitating better conversations, more constructive, more productive conversations. Because again, my experience was that the conversations, by and large, not all of them, but by and large, were resulting in such deep offense, frustration, and then alienation, and we all just walk away. We can't even communicate. And so I wanted to see if I could do anything about that. And so over the last year and a half, I've been working on a documentary about the entire issue and experience of what it means to be homosexual and Mormon. Not only just focusing on gay Mormons, but also family members, ecclesiastical leaders, theoreticians of all variety that have something to say about this issue. And in that process also applied a lot of study to the concept of empathy and concepts of communication and the role of the experience of intimate self-disclosure can have, the power that it can have in building empathy in the context of these conversations, meaning sharing of your own experience, in a sense, to enable or increase the capacity of the other person to understand you intellectually and emotionally. So that's empathy. And so, again, in throughout this process, we've also started a nonprofit where we actually work with our communities just here in Salt Lake and in Provo and northern Utah, both, again, in specific family homes, and then also in the community at the public libraries where we invite people to come together to have these empathy-building conversations where it's literally a practice session. Because in my experience, though many theoreticians say that we are sort of hardwired or softwired to have the capacity to empathize because of our old sort of tribal experience, that because of cultural influences, we've maybe have been losing those skills, losing that hardwiring or softwiring. And so it does take practice for many of us. Not some of us are born with a gift. I'm not one of them. So we've come to a bit of a methodology that we share with other people, and in the hope and the effort of helping to give tips and ideas of how to engage one another in a way that increases our mutual empathy. And I want to be really clear that this isn't just with an agenda of everybody should empathize with the gay Mormons. Of course, I feel that way, but that really is genuinely not the intent. It has to be a mutually applied empathy both ways. And as I mentioned in a session before, one of the most powerful impacts of engaging in this sort of exercise is not just that you do increase in your empathy for the other human being, you actually understand yourself better. Because if you engage with one another with the appropriate questions that help you understand them, and they do it reciprocally, you're actually challenged to understand, what are my thoughts and my feelings about this? Why do I feel and think this way? What is my history? What experiences have taught me this or convinced me of that? Which, you know, more self-awareness is good for all of us. So I just want to share some of the tips that we provide in these settings where we we facilitate these empathy building conversations. First thing is, we create sort of a blanket ground rule for everyone that as you engage in this conversation, there really are just two things that should be coming out of your mouth, basically. You are either asking a question that you genuinely do not understand about the other person's thoughts or experiences. Genuinely don't understand. So asking the question or sharing from your own personal experience, sort of using that the I language, in response to the other person's or somebody else's question. And that's it. So this is not a place for debate over the politics or the theology, religion, or so on. Those are appropriate conversations in other contexts, but this one is set aside specifically to help one another increase in empathy and apply that empathy towards compassion. So those are the two things that should be coming out of your mouth. Sorry for the simple vernacular. Here are the rest of the tips. One is to listen patiently with grace, to not be provoked. Meaning, of course, be patient as you sit and listen, try to process and understand the other person. But for me, the bigger issue here is to literally rely on, pray for, call on grace, because sometimes it does take that grace, the transcendent power from outside of yourself, to sit and listen and absorb, because we have those instincts to want to react or be easily provoked. So it does take, you know, a measure of grace to sit and listen and process what the other person is saying. Another tip is to only share from your own lived experiences, using the I terminology. So to avoid the universalizing or the preaching that we can often do, like I just did. So again, speaking from the I language, avoiding the universalizing and the preaching, and then only sharing from your lived experiences, because again, it's from those lived experiences that you have gained your thinking and your feelings and your ideas about this particular issue that may be so divisive in your relationship. Another tip is to be genuinely vulnerable, and that vulnerability applies on both sides of this equation. It's both be vulnerable enough to ask the questions, again, that you genuinely don't understand. Be vulnerable enough to admit, I don't understand this about your experience, your thoughts, your history, whatever it is. I'm trying to understand, but it takes some real vulnerability that you should actually make yourself conscious of, because sometimes we're not aware of, why am I not willing to ask that question? Well, it's because it puts me in a very vulnerable place. So you've got to consciously be willing to be vulnerable. And that with that vulnerability, couple a genuine inquisitiveness, which sometimes we don't always have. You know, we're processing our own life experience and histories, and so we lack that basic inquisitiveness to say, well, wait, I don't understand that and that and that, and if you say this, I need to understand this better, and so on. So be willing enough to be vulnerable and inquisitive. A general guideline is also to speak in ways that draw one another further into the conversation rather than driving each other out, which is actually a huge statement, and there's a lot of complexity to it. But we can be sort of self-aware of the language that we use in a way that it doesn't cause the other person to become defensive, that we're not speaking in an offensive way, obviously. And try to cultivate that instinct of, am I saying this in a way that will make them feel encouraged to continue to answer my questions and share with me, or am I sort of, in a way, insulting them through my question? You know, there's those subtle differences. So draw one another in rather than driving each other out. Another one is to set aside what turn out to be settled assumptions, and that's sort of a loaded term, which requires a lot of self-awareness, in that we often are not aware of how many assumptions we actually do make about the other person that we're engaged with. We don't realize that actually is just an assumption, that idea that we have in our head. But it's settled, and that's why we don't realize it's an assumption, because we feel that, well, this is settled, I understand this about you. But if we're able to be more honest and vulnerable, we can pull that apart and realize, actually, maybe this is just an assumption, and I need to put that out there and find out, is this accurate, or is this just an assumption? So again, be vulnerable and willing enough to acknowledge what are subtle assumptions. And those are, oh, and one more, sorry, not all. The last one is to acknowledge a sense of shared ignorance, meaning, at the end of the day, it refers sort of to Nephi's quote, where he says, I know not the meaning of all things, which genuinely is the experience if we're all honest enough. There are people, of course, who are experts in different fields and different ideas, but on much of these conversations where we're trying to just understand the other person's human lived experience, there aren't really any right answers. Nobody's the expert except for that other individual. And so if we can acknowledge a sense of shared ignorance, that creates a fertile ground for to become inquisitive and try to understand and grapple with one another about the issues that we're trying to understand. So that's all. It's about seven points there. And as we work with people and try to facilitate these conversations and practice these principles, we do try to emphasize an understanding of the distinction between empathy, sympathy, and compassion. Because often, as we engage people in this attempt to build empathy for other people, one of the first impediments genuinely almost always is that they do conflate sympathy with empathy. And something within them instinctually just says, well, if I really try to engage and understand that person, I'm going to have to agree with them. And that isn't necessarily true. There is a proper and a healthy distinction between the two. They may flow one from another into the other, but it's not necessarily the same thing. And for many people, again, bringing it back to my applied specific situation of trying to help people process the issues about homosexuality and Mormonism, that is the number one impediment, is if I open myself up to the lived experience of this other person and try to understand them, I'm going to have to agree with all their choices. And that completely shuts down the conversation from the get-go. So if we really try to emphasize the differences, it at least opens the door for them to realize, oh, I actually have a lot of ground to cover in terms of just empathizing, because I genuinely don't know what it's like to be a parent of a gay child, to be a bishop of a gay individual in the ward, to be a gay member in the church. You know, there's so much that we don't understand about each other's experiences. So I think I'm going to leave it at that.
Tell them how they can find out about your organization.
The organization is called Empathy First Initiative, and we have a website. It's empathyfirstinitiative.org. And then the film project that we're working on, which I should say, all this sort of theoretical groundwork that I did for about a year was preparation for me to then apply in the making of the film called Far Between, about homosexuality and Mormonism, because I wanted to make sure that in my communications and my engagements with this issue and with all the people touched by it, that I was doing the best I could, according to my conscience and my homework, to engage the issue, engage these individuals in a way that adheres to these principles, that draws them out, allows them to feel safe and feel understood. And then in the filmmaking itself, I'm trying to apply all these principles so that when an audience engages with the final film, it feels like an empathy-building conversation, and it's constructive, and it's helpful, and it's loving, and not accusatory or defensive or offensive. So the film project is called Far Between, and more information on that is at farbetweenmovie.com. Thank you.
I think maybe as someone who works on a magazine that emphasizes the sharing our experiences as a way to understand each other, I went with the, I think I don't have to answer the question later, because I'm going with my own personal experience being an interfaith hospital chaplain. And so how I learned empathy in a rather painful way some days, meeting with patients. My first experience to become a chaplain, you need to have a graduate degree in theology or divinity, and then you have to complete some units. They're called clinical pastoral education units, and they can be in a prison, or they can be in a hospital, or they can be with an NGO. They're places that you really go to learn empathy in the trenches. So generally what happens in a CPE unit is you go there and they give you the orientation. In my case, it was a hospital. They give you hospital orientation. They gave me my floor assignment list. They said I could sit in on a visit with a chaplaincy staff. And then we couldn't find anyone who wanted six interns watching the chaplain have an empathetic visit with them. So we didn't really get that. And then the next day we came to class, and we had a nice little kind of devotional thing, and talked about our fears. And if I'd known what they were going to say next, I think our fears would have been very different. They said, okay, go do your first visit. Nothing about anything, really. Just go for it. So I went upstairs terrified, and the only experience I had to draw from was that I had had an extended hospital stay as a teenager with a chronic illness, and I had spent 6 weeks in the hospital, but my hospital didn't have hospital chaplains. Many don't. So I'd never seen a chaplain. I had no idea what they did, but I knew I wanted to embody the scripture that was in our panel from Mosiah about mourning with those who mourn, and I really wanted to do that. Somehow I thought I'd get some instruction and the rest would come. So, also in chaplaincy, the interns do something called a verbatim. And in those verbatims, we have to describe the room and the patient and who is with the patient and how we acted and how the patient acted. And then we do a word for word, to the best of our ability, recreation of the visit. And so 11 years later, I have that, and I was going to read it to you, but it kind of made me cringe a little too much. So I'm going to give you highlights. It's also, it probably only take about 45 seconds to read it, but I'll give you highlights of it. So I talk about how I go to this floor, and it is the orthopedic floor, because I figured orthopedics would be easier than the oncology ward I had. I could do that. I could be compassionate and empathetic and not worry too much about saying something wrong to someone who is really suffering with life and death. Oh, and I also thought they won't ask me about life and death if I went to the orthopedic floor. So I went to see this very gracious older black man. He was in his late 60s, and he was wearing his pajamas, which if you go to the hospital much, you know that people who are in their pajamas are feeling better. They have, I like to say for myself, I haven't completely given up being in the hospital when I'm able to put on my pajamas versus those backless gowns. And his wife was with them, and his patient file listed his religious preference as Christian. So I came up to him and I said, my name's Emily. I'm one of the chaplaincy interns, and I just want to stop by to see how you're doing today, hoping he would fill in the rest. And he says he's pretty well, and then I ask some insensitive questions that do we need to go into here? I don't think we do. And about his religiosity. And then as soon as I found a way to say, has your pastor been in to see you? And he said yes, and I said, oh great, so you're taken care of. Well, it was so nice to meet you. And this visit took 45 seconds. And it was so rushed. And I realized that I came in with my own agenda, though it was a sincere agenda of wanting to be empathetic and to show love and compassion. But I had put up all these walls, so we couldn't really have a conversation, even though, in retrospect, he was really quite willing to have a conversation with me. As I look back on his body language now, and just the smile he had, this was a man who was willing to engage with me. So, over the years, or during that first year of chaplaincy, I tried to show empathy the only way I knew how. I went from my experience of being a white, middle-class Mormon from the Southwest, and knowing what I wanted in a chaplaincy visit, and then applying it to everyone who was in a urban teaching hospital in Boston. So I was trying to show empathy by applying my hospital experience, which I think is a good first step. I was thinking and overthinking, and except for the preacher who met me when I was visibly pregnant before he was about to go into surgery, and I asked him if he wanted to pray with me, and he said, really not, because you're Mormon, and you and your unborn child are going to hell.
Any other questions?
I found, for the most part, people were really very willing to give me the gift of empathy and compassion as they saw me struggle through these visits. I think in Mormonism, we do tend to struggle with empathy because it requires us to be vulnerable in a way that our black and white teaching in the church setting can sometimes leave us ill-equipped to do. But we have a couple things going for us that I'd like to share. We are really good workers, I think. I think as a church that has a lay clergy, we have an excellent opportunity to develop both empathy and sympathy as we are put in these situations and hearing these stories that I think most of the population never gets to hear. So we learn to work as leaders, and I think we just have this ethic of work from our pioneer heritage, both today, both modern-day pioneers who do brave things, and the Salt Lake pioneers that we hear about often, and we have hymns like Put Your Shoulder to the Wheel. And we are a church, one of the few denominations that still often quotes James 2:17, even so faith, if it hath not works, is dead, being alone. And we wrestle with that scripture. And I think we can struggle with empathy because we are a group that likes to have an answer, that we like to be able to say when someone is saying, I'm having a hard time, we like to say, and here's how you fix that. Now, I think that desire to have an answer makes us a very compassionate people. And it is one thing that I love most about my people, is that we do say, can I bring you a meal? Or the famous end of a visiting teaching or home teaching visit is, what can I do for you? And I think we are able to be compassionate. I think that is one thing we do very well. But how much better could we be compassionate if we were able to show empathy and to let go of our agendas and to be open and vulnerable in our dialogues with each other? As a chaplain, I found some ways to do this because I had really lovely mentors in the chaplaincy staff. I had supervisors who would gently model for me as I talked to them about my visits and how difficult they were for me. And they would listen, and they taught me something about long periods of silence, where I would say, so I did this, and isn't that terrible? And they just look at me and smile for a really long time sometimes. And I learned, oh, I hated those long periods of silence. And they are kind of, if you've ever met with a chaplain, they're kind of the hallmark of our trade, because it is in those silences that we are, many of us, not all of us, are bumped out of our comfort zones, because in American society, we like to keep the conversation going, and when there's silence, we have to reassess if we said something wrong or what's going on. So I learned those, I learned about long periods of silence and the power that those have. And I found a lot of help in simple Buddhist practices, like breathing and meditation. If you could hear in that verbatim, I have a problem slowing down sometimes. And so it helps to think about those, and Thich Nhat Hanh's books actually really helped me quite a bit in doing this, to slow down and to let my own desire of control and views about how the visit should go not dictate the meeting, and to really work on losing those views about how a visit should go. One quote from him that I often think of is, attachment to views is the greatest impediment to the spiritual path. I think it's also the greatest impediment to our spiritual conversations with each other when we're in gospel doctrine or when we're in a home teaching or visiting teaching environment, and we keep spitting out those answers. That's why I was so good in primary. I knew those three answers by the time I was a CTR. Any question was just pray, go to church, and read your scriptures. But when we're willing to ask harder questions and we're willing to think and be vulnerable, I think we have true empathy and true dialogue in our conversations with each other. So we don't teach this a lot in church. I don't think we use the language of empathy. I do hear sympathy sometimes, and I do hear compassion a lot. And as I've been doing this panel, I've been wondering, particularly with my own children, how I can better teach empathy. And I think if we look to the scriptures, we have the language there. It just needs to be reinterpreted a little bit. And I find we can have greater empathy by looking at it on two levels. One, as individuals having empathy, and then the ultimate goal is as we as a community have empathy, to share that empathy as a foundation of our community. So our model of empathy and compassion is Christ, and I think of Christ's ability to show love as he sat with people and taught them and healed them, and that loving one another is our great commandment. And when we are able to love one another, I think we also need to define that as being willing to know that that love and feel that that love is unconditional on both sides of the conversation. One of my favorite scriptures is Moroni 7:47. It says, but charity is the pure love of Christ, and it endureth forever. And whoso is found possessed of it at the last day, it shall be well with him. And we think of charity in the larger cultural context, but I love thinking of charity as a gift that we give each other, as that pure love of Christ that we're all working on nurturing and growing within each other. As I view charity as synonymous with love and a gift that I give in my meeting with other people, both as a chaplain and as a wife and as a mother and as someone in this society, it reminds me of the importance of loving and serving my sisters and brothers in this world. If we look at 1 Corinthians chapter 13, verse 4, I think we have the keys on how to develop empathy. It says, charity suffereth long and is kind. Charity envieth not. Charity vaunteth not itself. Is not puffed up. In charity suffereth long, we see the time commitment that it requires to have empathy, both in our daily interactions with each other and slowing down and showing that empathy. and in and just having time and investing in a community. We see, and is kind and charity envieth not us, not, and charity envieth not. We see the sincerity to be compassionate and to show empathy. And I have to say that in my experience, just being sincere and having the desire to develop this skill has gone such a long way in people being willing to give me that empathy too. I think we can all often tell when someone's really trying, and even if they are uncomfortable and not sure where they're going, we're often willing to see that sincerity and let that, and let things that might hurt us to know that those are part of growing and being vulnerable with each other, and be kind and charitable. And is not puffed up is the last part of that scripture. And that humility that also has to accompany being empathetic, that we need to have when we are engaging in conversations where we may not, as Kendall said, be ready to agree or say, yes, you're right on every point. But the humility to know that we can have a conversation that teaches us. As we work on developing that empathy and that love and that charity, I think we can come together as a community, and we have this ideal expressed in all the scriptures we see, Joseph Smith and Paul and Jesus Christ, expressing this ideal of being, of having these qualities that we're talking about on this panel today. And I think they do that in, as they describe being of one mind, of building Zion, when we are willing to be empathetic with each other and be vulnerable, I think we go a long way towards building a community of one mind and share that love with each other. Thank you.
Brother and sister, thank you very much for those remarks. I work in interreligious diplomacy on a daily basis, and so I read between a lot of your lines, and I really appreciate that, and I'm going to respond to your comments right now with a quick story. This last year, we've been filming a dialogue in L.A. between four Prop 8 ministers, chaplains, on one side of the issue and four on the other side of the issue, and the subject was, how does your religion inform your position on Prop 8? We're not interested in what your position is. How does your religion inform your position? It's a great way to get into the deep stuff. And the lady, the LDS lady that happened to be in the dialogue was with a very fine Episcopalian gay minister who has a large congregation in L.A. in their dialogue. And they were going at it always with respect, but deep frustration. And toward the end of the dialogue, she said, well, you understand, everyone is born with a handicap. We're all handicapped. And we all have compassion on each other. And he said, no, you don't understand. This isn't a handicap. And it was at that great moment where they understood each other. They did understand each other. When they understood, the analogy did not work, and both of them grabbed it. How can it not be a handicap? Another, I'm open now to learn something. And the other team back, you know, everybody has a handicap. I'm not looking down on you. I'm looking, you know, all of us have problems. You know, so it's a very interesting moment where both went there. They still didn't get it up. You know, you could see at the end, it still didn't work. And we turned the film off, blasted, and we ended the dialogue, and they just sat there looking at each other, and then simultaneously, I cannot tell you who moved first, but BAM! Mm-hmm. They hugged each other and cried. It was the only one of the whole event where we had that kind of explosive, nonverbal dialogue at the end. It was fantastic. I turn on the camera.
And the camera was on.
And, you know, as you'll hear later, we don't have the record of the city of Enoch. For some reason, the good stuff is off camera, you know? And I think there's a lesson there in this world we're in. But anyhow, I'm going to call this little spiel All Eternity Shook. And it'll go in a different direction. For some reason, whenever I get together with Bob, he gets me to meditate on issues that I hadn't thought about, and I've gone into a theological rant here that is directly related to the idea of empathy, sympathy, and compassion, and I think I'm going to focus on compassion in my spiel. In Moses 7, I'm going to relate, if you will, if you're looking for two things to grab on in this 10 minutes, there are two Gethsemane scenes in the scriptures. One in this Gethsemane and the other's in Moses 7. And you'll see why I'm saying Moses 7 is actually a Gethsemane scene. Let me go there and just give this one little verse. We know the story. Enoch looks at God. You know, who would want to be God? If you're crying and you're in charge of everything, you know, what's going on here? You know, what kind of a universe do we have if God's crying, right? What's peace? What's heaven like? And then the Lord responds, and with a rather long response, but in verse 40 says, "Wherefore, for this shall the heavens weep, yea, and all the workmanship of mine hands. Should not the heavens weep, seeing that these suffer? Should not I, God, weep, seeing that these, my children that I love, are treating each other this way, or hating each other, hating their own blood?" And this is important to my reading. Enoch is not God. Enoch is a human being. And what does Enoch do? It says, "And it came to pass that the Lord spake unto Enoch and told Enoch all the doings of the children of men." So he showed him everything. He showed him everything. Knowledge. Gave him the sight to see all he was doing. "Wherefore Enoch knew and looked upon the wickedness and the misery, and wept, and stretched forth his arms, and his heart swelled wide as eternity, and his bowels yearned, and all eternity shook." Was that God that caused all eternity to shake? Enoch, our human counterpart, when he got into compassion in the deepest way, in a massive way, it caused all eternity to shake. Now, that's influence, that's power, that's an experience that I say is part of what Zion is. It's part of what gave him the leadership to bring Zion. He had an experience that shook eternity in himself in relation to God, but he reflected God's compassion in himself, had an experience. Okay. Now, we go to Gethsemane. Mark 14 is my favorite passage there. And we have the Lord going to Gethsemane. And in verse 32, "And they came to a place which was named Gethsemane, and he saith to his disciples, Sit ye here while I shall pray. And he taketh with him Peter and James and John, and began to be sore amazed." I went back and tried to do a little exegesis on that. Utterly astonished, bamboozled, okay, and to be very heavy. I'm looking at amazed. This is God on earth who is utterly astonished. Here's a Mormon God, surprised. All right? Utterly surprised. You don't like to be in a universe where God could be surprised, right? Utterly astonished, sore amazed. Well, and he said, my soul is exceeding sorrowful unto death. Tarry ye here. Exceedingly sorrowful unto death. Again, God saying, I feel like dying. I'm utterly amazed. If you put this together with why hast thou forsaken me later on, you can bring this cross experience back into Gethsemane in a good old Mormon way, right? That utter amazement. Well, what's he utterly amazed at? Again, let's go to the Book of Mormon on this one, Alma 7. I'm almost finished with this little spiel on this one. What's he utterly amazed at? Well, some might say, well, the pain. Okay? Didn't know it could hurt this bad. But what is our story? What is our story? What is he doing there? What do we usually think he's doing there? Alma helps us. In 7 he says, and he shall go forth, suffering the pains and afflictions and temptations. I underline the word, and temptations. That also really worries a lot of theologians. God can't be really tempted. Of every kind. And this, that the word might be fulfilled, as saith, he will take upon him the pains and sicknesses of his people. And he will take upon him their infirmities, that his bowels may be filled with mercy according to the flesh, that he may know according to the flesh how to succor his people. Now the Spirit knoweth all things. My reading. In the premortal life, he had it all figured out. I got it. I see the plan. I'm in, right? Not for my glory, no, I mean, but I'm in. Gets in a body, comes down here, the veil's partially down, not completely at times. In Gethsemane, what happens? He has an experience where some fashion, he has utter compassion for each human being. He gets into our lives in some way. And sees what we've gone through, and he's utterly astonished. He's utterly amazed of what we put up with, knowing what we know, a little what we know. That's the God we worship, is a God who doesn't see compassion as a virtue. Compassion, The thing I'll end on is this idea of the paraclete, or the Holy Spirit. I'm with you now, but another one will come who will be with you more somehow. And the idea of with and in is crucial to what we're talking about here today. I'm a social psychologist. Most people think about compassion as an experience of understanding or trying to grasp, both from emotional feeling and an intellectual way, the experience of another human being. But for Christians and Latter-day Saints particularly, there is the idea of standing with, not standing under, but standing with, so we withstand each other. And then the idea of standing or being in, the indwelling relationship. It goes with the erotic idea of interpenetration, of being more than just helping, but having the deep desire to become, and to become what someone else is, and have them become what you are, to be more than you are, by somehow becoming what someone else is. This deep idea of worship or emulation doesn't just go to God, but for us it goes to the deep desire, the human desire. This idea of what I call it deep sociality of heaven and earth is where we can look into another eternal being's eyes and say, I don't want to just help you. I want to be somehow you. And I want you to be somehow me. Without uniting fully, because that gets creepy. We've got to be our individual selves somehow. And so it's this miraculous thing that is compassion for us, is this deep desire to be more than just helpful. Now, that's why marriage is not a metaphor for us. But that's why we can sort of marry friends. Jesus said, you're no longer servants, you're friends. we have this idea of this deep becoming another person in a relationship of influence. And it's that mutuality of the influence that is, I'll end with this problem. I can end now. Influence can be either contamination, enrichment, or insemination. There are different forms of influence. We can't avoid influence. We will all be in relations of influence. For Mormons, probably, it's an infinite regression of influence. Okay? We don't... There's never, like Rene Girard says, there are always interdividuals. There's always been a sociality, apparently, for intelligences. But when we sit down in dialogue, when we sit down with someone and they think they're going to hell because of their behaviors, or not, when you're spiritually centered, the question really becomes is, how much of that influence do I really desire today? How much do I really desire? How much of you do I want in me? And how much do I want to give to you? And there's no answer to that. And that's where discernment lies. That's who we become together. And that's why compassion is not child's play. Dialogue is not child's play. We will come away changed. And at times, we will come away contaminated in a way that we're not pleased with. And other times they'll come away utterly astonished at how much there was there in the other that we now have in ourselves. That is so awesome that we are now amazingly bigger than we ever thought we could be. So this idea of compassion then is an idea of social greed kind of thing, where we really do want more of each other. And it's Jesus is not this person who has this sympathy of altruism. For the joy that was set before him, he endured the cross. Well, what is that joy? It's this thing we're talking about. This, we call it love. But it's this love that somehow is a social integration that's one-on-one. And then when we put it all together, something called Zion, it's amazing. And it's not just Mormons, we all know that. So I hope these random theological musings respond to the idea. I will now end with a personal story. It was the first day of my mission in France. I was in a town called Belfort. I got off the train. I have it in my mind to this day. It was 1965. I was pulling a large trunk behind my senior companion. We came around the corner after we left the station. Bright sun was coming down, and it was probably 2 in the afternoon, and there was a wine bibber, a drunk, on the street, on the sidewalk, just laid out, disheveled, completely. And as I was passing him, and I looked down again, and every once in a while in life you have an experience that you don't know where it's coming from. This one hit me. I looked down at this person. He was asleep. And I had an experience of going into the person somehow and going back and forth and back and forth. My companion said, "Hey, Elder, what's the matter?" And in that few seconds, what happened to me was I had an experience where I realized that that person's thoughts and feelings were of absolute equal value to mine in his eternal life. That we had a theology that said, no matter what we are down here, a God of love handicaps us all so that wherever we are, what we do matters. That's where our equality is. Not in the deal we get, not in our personalities, not our intelligence. What is equal is the love of God will handicap us all based on where we are. And therefore, we can look at anybody and say, that person is just as important to God and to me as any other person, because whatever they do incredibly matters. God will leverage it to make them capable of eternal life. And it was a great experience for me to be able to go in, therefore, out of all my relationships thereafter and say, yeah, you are. I'm not into equality in the way you think of equality, because that's phony. We're not equal. But I'm into an equality in the face of God, where we have this amazing God who has given us all differences down here, but equally gives us this awesome chance to become divine beings. I think that's a sign I'm over.
Well, we've had three great perspectives on these ideas of empathy and sympathy and compassion. And I'm coming from it from a slightly different perspective, as each of us has, trying to look at kind of how we view these notions and how we practice them. That's my biggest interest. Not the theology of it so much, or the philosophy, or the whatever, but kind of, you know, what I was thinking of as I was hearing these discussions is the prophet Joseph, who says, man filled with the love of God is not content with blessing his family alone, but ranges through the whole world, anxious to bless the whole human race. And I don't know if that's empathy. I don't know if that's sympathy. I don't know if that's compassion. But I think this undergirding dimension of the foundation of our human relationships with others is a big piece of this. So my context, I want to talk about these ideas and ways to practice them within a framework of looking at society today with its problems, its poverty. We're constantly lately exposed to this interesting notion that America is rapidly becoming one of the most unequal societies on the planet. And the opportunities to move ahead and improve your well-being is less now than it's ever been in our history. And when I see articles like I've picked up in the press in Utah just in the last week or two about a huge increase in poverty in Utah, in our little Zion, which for those of us who live here in Utah, this is Zion, right? Apologies to all of you from California and Boston and LA and all that stuff. But it just seems like there's such a huge contradiction. We have this theology that preaches dimensions of compassion and sympathy, and yet somehow we're not able to practice it in our own communities, in our own state, in our own country, as well as around the world, the globe. If we take a perspective of what's happening around the planet, we see huge losses of wealth in the lives of many Europeans and North Americans. Other parts of the world haven't gone through the Great Recession we have as much as we have. My friends in Brazil and the Workers' Party there, President Lula and now Dilma, are solving some of their problems in fairly fascinating, dramatic ways that we could probably learn something for. But as I think about this, I think about how we can learn more about compassion and empathy and sympathy by reaching out and sacrificing in building relationships, brotherhood, sisterhood, community with those who have so much less. And my hypothesis is, if you want to learn more about these notions of compassion or sympathy or empathy, one of the best ways to do it is get down in the trenches, get dirty with the poor, see what it's like. There's some friends of mine that are non-Latter-day Saints that are in California, college kids. They said, we want to know. We see that over a billion on the planet, people today, live on less than a dollar a day. So we're going to go to Central America and live like that and see what life is like for a dollar a day. They went for 40-something days. They came back. They said, we now know what empathy is. We know what sympathy is. And they didn't talk about compassion so much, but that was implied in everything they said. So get there, be with those who suffer, look into their eyes, feel that pain. That's a way to do this. I think we as a church, as you mentioned, we have great possibilities. We have great teachings. we have words like Section 58, which talks about not being commanded in all things, but doing many good things of their own free will, right? President Hinckley said on a number of occasions, he said, "I'm not so worried about our willingness to serve others." Well, there's two quotes here. Let me give, first one I'm thinking of is President Kimball, who said, "I'm not so worried about the saints wanting to serve the poor. I'm just worried that they're not aware, that they're not as aware as they need to be." And then President Hinckley's comment, kind of a couple decades later, building off of that, has been that he said, "I worry that we're over-institutionalizing our service to the poor. We're over-institutionalizing, in other words, our compassion, our charity, our building relationships with those who have so little." And so what I want to suggest is there's ways we can act beyond our beliefs, beyond reading our scriptures. What else did you say? The big three: read the scriptures, go to church,
pray.
And maybe a fourth is pay. Make that tithing contribution. That's the fourth. We practice that in Provo. I don't know about Arizona. It might be a different church down there. But how can we reach out beyond the programs of the institution and in the process find ourselves and find our relationships with the Lord? I think we do have this tremendous LDS legacy of changing the world. I'm in the Marriott School at BYU, so I've got all these kids coming through the MBA program, and they really believe they're going to make a difference, and a ton of them do it. They're not passive. They're not, waiting for the system to tell me what to do. When they see problems, they like to act, and their MBA gives them a greater sense of that capability. But I think among many Mormons all over the globe, I see this Zion vision. I see this reaching out. I see people saying, "I can see the world as it is, and I can make a difference. I can change things." There's about 200 nonprofits, NGOs, non-governmental organizations working all over the globe that didn't exist 20 years ago, that are based here in Utah and a few in Arizona, a few in California. Started by Latter-day Saints. People, some cases, they went on missions, they came back, they said, "I promise those people I'm going to come back someday and help them." And they start these little efforts. For my work, I focus mostly on microfinance, microcredit, helping develop systems and strategies to give tiny loans to the poor of $50 or $100 to start with, and then them learning how to manage that money, build a business, pay the loan off, get a $100 loan next time, then $200, then $400, and eventually, some of our clients we have now around the world have 300-400 people working with them in these businesses. And last year, together, the NGOs we've started, sorry about that, the 26 or so that I work with primarily with my students over the years, just last year alone, we raised $31 million. In microloans, too, and we have about 7 million clients now. That came because many of these kids said, "I don't like what I see. We can't be Zion when there's rich and poor, or when the gap is so great, at least, that those at the bottom are suffering and those at the top have an excess of resources and what they can do." So let me just share a couple of examples of ways I've seen Latter-day Saints, like some of you, make a difference. One of them is a little organization called Help International that was started by a group of students and myself in 1998-99 when Hurricane Mitch destroyed Central America. And we watched the suffering and we saw the problems, and I went to the dean and said, "I'd like to start a little project with my class next semester. So I want to drop one of my regular teaching assignments and teach something on how to change the world." A humble little title for a humble little course. And the dean said, "Well, you're already scheduled. You can't." I said, "Well, I want to do this Can we just drop one of the traditional organization behavior courses? No, we can't do that. So I said, okay, I'm going to teach it as an overload. Then if we succeed in getting a few students, and he interrupted me and said, no, you won't have any students. They're not going to show up to a course like that. He said, you'll be lucky to get five students. And this was in, I don't know, you guys, were any of you live in 98, 99? You know, this is before the internet, before Al Gore invented the internet, whatever. We didn't post stuff online, but I made some flyers. We had copy machines by then and posted them around campus and just said, we're going to have a class every Monday and Wednesday, 5 to 6 o'clock. Little course on anyone on this campus who's interested in trying to reduce human suffering in Central America. First day I started the class, there was 5 students. I said, first time in my life, the dean is right. But the next class, they told others, 10 students. The next week, 15 or 20. It grew to 86 students. And about half of them were involved in teams planning the strategy to practice empathy, sympathy, and compassion in Latin America in response to a destroyed country called Honduras that was set back 50 years economically. And we organize these little teams. Students organize them, learn different aspects of doing development, doing microcredit, becoming social entrepreneurs, teaching business Spanish, stuff like that. And we had 47 go down in the summer and spend 6 weeks to 3 or 4 months doing that kind of work. And it was an amazing transformational experience for many of these students, as it was for me. And out of that, many of these other projects have started from that early year. And that organization, the dean said, I asked him for financing. He said, no, we can't fund that. We've got to fund students going to other places. And I said, where? And he said, Wall Street. You know, they're going to do their internships on Wall Street. I said, we just need a little money to do internships with the poor. Couldn't get it done. I said, Lynn, we're going to raise it. We raised $116,000 that summer and gave out about, a few hundred loans. But I just remember that this is my compassion, passion, empathy, sympathy experience. In one of the first little groups of women we started working with were a group of Latter-day Saints in Comayagua, which is about a half an hour outside the Tegucigalpa, the capital of Honduras. And we had been training these women to become micro-entrepreneurs. We're going to give them each a $100 loan with which they're going to start a little business. And it's amazing what you can do with $100 in these countries. And the day came, the training had occurred. The day came to organize the women into their own little bank. They elected their own leaders, and we brought $100 in quetzales for each one of them. And we announced the first woman to get the loan. Her name was Maria Elena. I think it was Maria Elena. And she started to stand up, and then she burst into tears and sat back down. And we're sitting under a banyan tree between a couple of houses out in this little village. Impoverished environment, and the students that were with me said, "Oh, Maria, come on! You know we're so excited to have you receive the first loan. Everybody wanted you to get the first loan to start your micro enterprise." And she said, "Oh, I just can't do it. I can't." And she cried again. And so a couple of the women volunteers with me, they went and brought her up front, and trying to provide some encouragement and express their solidarity as well as empathy with her. And I said to her in Spanish, "Well, Maria, why don't you want to get this loan? This is going to change your children's life." She was a single mom and had 5 children, and she said, no, I can't do this, hermano. I am just a poor Indian woman. I am not worth $100. And I was so shocked by that. She'd been a member about 6 or 7 years at the church. Many of the women around her were Relief Society sisters in her little ward, rural ward. And there she was feeling She wasn't worth anything. So I'm out of time. I'm going to give you a handout that lists some of these sorts of organizations that some of you may want to get involved with. And maybe that involvement is going down for 2 weeks and seeing this kind of work. Maybe that involvement is writing a little check in addition to your taxes, in addition to your church contributions. The power we have as Latter-day Saints to draw deep on the scriptures, on the spirit, and on the sense of brotherhood and sisterhood we have as Latter-day Saints, I think propels us and offers us fantastic opportunities to truly make the difference. So I hope you'll see this, my discussion at least, as a sort of a call to action and practice of compassion. Thanks very much.
This turned out better than I expected. Such wonderful expressions, and I think that to be able to go from the ideas to the concrete application of those, and Werner's been helpful in a little foundation some friends and I started called the Leah Hona Children's Foundation, where we are taking food, nutrition supplements and education to Latter-day Saint children in about 12 states now in Guatemala, Ecuador, and Chile. And what is encouraging to us is how many Latter-day Saints spontaneously want to participate in these kinds of things, the kind of expression that Werner got from these students who very often don't know what to do. They don't, you know, just some little thing in my wards for the vast number of years at Christmas time, I've just said, here are two or three charities that are run by Latter-day Saints, and if any of you feel inspired to contribute something to them, this is how to do it. And sometimes we've raised $1,500 to $2,000, which is a lot of money, as Werner said, for these people. I'm hoping, Werner, maybe we could get something. You probably are way ahead of me on this, but the Perpetual Enterprise Fund to
Perpetual Education
Fund. To complement.
To a Perpetual Enterprise Fund.
Yeah. To see if we could get the church involved in doing that.
I'm working on that. It's called the Family Sustainability Fund.
That doesn't
surprise
me. The church
is still debating it, but it took 12 years when we started proposing Perpetual Education Fund. So we got a while to go.
Let me conclude here. I was hoping there would be time for question and answer, but you can each come up afterwards and buttonhole these people, and their experience is wonderful, and their perspectives and their values are such that we can all emulate them. My favorite definition of charity is one that I was reading in one of the introductions to the canon, New Testament. Charity is the unexpected lurch of the heart toward another person that takes the soul by surprise. Mm. Isn't that lovely? The Midrash, I'd like to close with two stories. One from the Midrash, which you who know me know I've been spending the last few years looking into. One is about Rabbi Ishmael, a rabbi who lived in the second century after Christ. He was among those Jews who was being tortured and persecuted by the Romans because he continued to be faithful to his Jewish faith. And they tortured him once so severely that he cried out. And in the Midrash it says, when God heard the cry of this pious rabbi, he declared from the heavens, if one more word comes from Rabbi Ishmael, I shall overturn the world. Hearing God's pledge, even though his suffering was great, Rabbi Ishmael refused to cry out again. Dying in silence, he saved the world. Which, of course, we see Christ's silence in the black spiritual. He never said a mumbling word. He refused to cry out. So that kind of ability to empathize to such a profound degree of self-sacrifice for others is, of course, the heart of the gospel. Second story illustrates all three virtues. It comes from my favorite. I teach the short story, or did teach the short story when I was a professor of literature. It's based on a short story by Raymond Carver called The Small Good Thing. In this story, a husband and a wife have a young son who's about 8. His name is Scotty. And it's Scotty's 8th birthday is coming up, and they call the bakery, and they order a birthday cake for Scotty. And then shortly thereafter, Scotty is crossing the street and is hit by a car. He is hospitalized, lapses into a coma, and then a few days later he dies. The baker, unaware of this, keeps calling. You know, you've ordered this cake, it's ready, come and pick it up. And the parents are so full of grief they can't respond to this. The baker keeps calling up, and then he gets kind of abusive with him. You know, you better come and get this cake. You've ordered it, and I need to be paid for it. And finally, one night, the couple go to the bakery to express their outrage at this man's behavior. When they tell them that their son is dead, he's embarrassed and ashamed. A simple man, he does the only thing that he knows how to do. He offers them some of his fresh baked bread and rolls. As they sit in the bakery, the darkened bakery, eating, he reveals his life of loneliness to them. He's childless. He talks about working 16 hours a day, baking thousands of wedding cakes and birthday cakes, and trying to imagine the celebrations surrounding each one of those cakes, none of which ever touch his life personally. Finally, he takes a fresh loaf of dark bread from the oven, breaks it open and offers it to them. "Smell this," he says. It's heavy bread, but it's rich. And Carver says they smelled it. Then he had them taste it. It had the taste of molasses and coarse grains. They listened to him. They ate what they could. They swallowed the dark bread. It was like daylight under the fluorescent trays of light. They talked down into the early morning, the high pale cast of light in the windows, and they did not think of leaving. This is a powerful story of loss, grief, death, forgiveness, and redemption. It's also a story about empathy, sympathy, compassion. The association of this story with bread and with light reminds us of Christ, who is both the bread of life and the light of the world, and who is the world's greatest examples of the virtues we've explored today in this panel. Partaking of the bread each week in sacrament meeting, we too taste of his light. It is a small, good thing that we do every Sunday, and is akin to the other small acts of empathy, sympathy, and compassion we give to one another. Those acts of love, it seems to me, have their genesis in the light of Christ, which is in every one of us. As Rumi says, when one of us gets lost, is not here, he must be inside us. There's no place like that anywhere in the world.